Joyce is as caring a mother as I've seen, but she had a steep learning curve as parent to her daughter because of their difference in temperaments. Would she have enjoyed a more natural parent-child fit if she'd been an introvert herself? Not necessarily. Introverted parents can face challenges of their own. Sometimes painful childhood memories can get in the way. Emily Miller, a clinical social worker in Ann Arbor, Michigan, told me about a little girl she treated, Ava, whose shyness was so extreme that it prevented her from making friends or from concentrating in class. Recently, she sobbed when asked to join a group singing in front of the classroom, and her mother, Sarah, decided to seek Miller's help. When Miller asked Sarah, a successful business journalist, to act as a partner in Ava's treatment, Sarah burst into tears. She'd been a shy child, too, and felt guilty that she'd passed on to Ava her terrible burden. "I hide it better now, but I'm still just like my daughter," she explained. "I can approach anyone, but only as long as I'm behind a journalist's notebook." Sarah's reaction is not unusual for the pseudo-extrovert parent of a shy child, says Miller. Not only is Sarah reliving her own childhood, but she's projecting onto Ava the worst of her own memories. But Sarah needs to understand that she and Ava are not the same person, even if they do seem to have inherited similar temperaments. For one thing, Ava is influenced by her father, too, and by any number of environmental factors, so her temperament is bound to have a different expression. Sarah's own distress need not be her daughter's, and it does Ava a great disservice to assume that it will be. With the right guidance, Ava may get to the point where her shyness is nothing more than a small and infrequent annoyance. But even parents who still have work to do on their own self-esteem can be enormously helpful to their kids, according to Miller. Advice from a parent who appreciates how a child feels is inherently validating. If your son is nervous on the first day of school, it helps to tell him that you felt the same way when you started school, and still do sometimes at work, but that it gets easier with time. Even if he doesn't believe you, you'll signal that you understand and accept him. You can also use your empathy to help you judge when to encourage him to face his fears and when this would be too overwhelming. For example, Sarah might know that singing in front of the classroom really is too big a step to ask Ava to take all at once. But she might also sense that singing in private with a small and simpatico group or with one trusted friend is a manageable first step, even if Ava protests at first. She can, in other words, sense when to push Ava, and how much. The psychologist Elaine Aron, whose work on sensitivity I described in Chapter 6, offers insight into these questions when she writes about Jim, one of the best fathers she knows. Jim is a carefree extrovert with two young daughters. The first daughter, Betsy, is just like him, but the second daughter, Lily, is more sensitive. A keen but anxious observer of her world. Jim is a friend of Aaron's, so he knew all about sensitivity and introversion. He embraced Lily's way of being, but at the same time, he didn't want her to grow up shy. So, writes Aaron, he became determined to introduce her to every potentially pleasurable opportunity in life, from ocean waves, tree climbing and new foods, to family reunions, soccer, and varying her clothes rather than wearing one comfortable uniform. In almost every instance, Lily initially thought these novel experiences were not such good ideas, and Jim always respected her opinion. He never forced her, although he could be very persuasive. He simply shared his view of a situation with her, the safety and pleasures involved, the similarities to things she already liked. He would wait for that little gleam in her eye that said she wanted to join in with the others, even if she couldn't yet. Jim always assessed these situations carefully to ensure that she would not ultimately be frightened, but rather be able to experience pleasure and success. Sometimes he held her back until she was overly ready. Above all, he kept it an internal conflict, not a conflict between him and her. And if she or anyone else comments on her quietness or hesitancy, Jim's prompt reply is, "That's just your style. Other people have different styles, but this is yours. You like to take your time and be sure. Jim also knows that part of her style is befriending anyone whom others tease, doing careful work, noticing everything going on in the family, and being the best soccer strategist in her league. One of the best things you can do for an introverted child is to work with him on his reaction to novelty. Remember that introverts react not only to new people, but also to new places and events. So don't mistake your child's caution in new situations for an inability to relate to others. He's recoiling from novelty or overstimulation, not from human contact. As we saw in the last chapter, introversion-extroversion levels are not correlated with either agreeableness or the enjoyment of intimacy. Introverts are just as likely as the next kid to seek others' company, though often in smaller doses. The key is to expose your child gradually to new situations and people, taking care to respect his limits, even when they seem extreme. This produces more confident kids than either overprotection or pushing too hard. Let him know that his feelings are normal and natural, but also that there's nothing to be afraid of. I know it can feel funny to play with someone you've never met, but I bet that boy would love to play trucks with you if you asked him. Go at your child's pace. Don't rush him. If he's young, make the initial introductions with the other little boy if you have to. And stick around in the background. Or, when he's really little, with a gentle, supportive hand on his back, for as long as he seems to benefit from your presence. When he takes social risks, let him know you admire his efforts. I saw you go up to those new kids yesterday. I know that can be difficult, and I'm proud of you. The same goes for new situations. Imagine a child who's more afraid of the ocean than are other kids the same age. Thoughtful parents recognize that this fear is natural and even wise. The ocean is indeed dangerous. But they don't allow her to spend the summer on the safety of the dunes, and neither do they drop her in the water and expect her to swim. Instead, they signal that they understand her unease while urging her to take small steps. Maybe they play in the sand for a few days, with the ocean waves crashing at a safe distance. Then one day, they approach the water's edge, perhaps with the child riding on a parent's shoulders. They wait for calm weather or low tide to immerse a toe, then a foot, then a knee. They don't rush. Every small step is a giant stride in a child's world. When ultimately she learns to swim like a fish, she has reached a crucial turning point in her relationship not only with water, but also with fear. Slowly your child will see that it's worth punching through her wall of discomfort to get to the fun on the other side. She'll learn how to do the punching by herself. As Dr. Kenneth Rubin, the director of the Center for Children, Relationships, and Culture at the University of Maryland, writes, if you're consistent in helping your young child learn to regulate his or her emotions and behaviors in soothing and supportive ways, something rather magical will begin to happen. In time, you might watch your daughter seem to be silently reassuring herself. Those kids are having fun. I can go over there. He or she is learning to self-regulate fearfulness and wariness. If you want your child to learn these skills, don't let her hear you call her shy. She'll believe the label and experience her nervousness as a fixed trait, rather than an emotion she can control. She also knows full well that shy is a negative word in our society. Above all, do not shame her for her shyness. If you can, it's best to teach your child self-coaxing skills while he's still very young, when there's less stigma associated with social hesitancy. Be a role model by greeting strangers in a calm and friendly way, and by getting together with your own friends. Similarly, invite some of his classmates to your house. Let him know gently that when you're together with others, it's not okay to whisper or tug at your pants leg to communicate his needs. He needs to speak up. Make sure that his social encounters are pleasant by selecting kids who aren't overly aggressive and play groups that have a friendly feel to them. Have your child play with younger kids if this gives him confidence, older kids if they inspire him. If he's not clicking with a particular child, don't force it. You want most of his early social experiences to be positive. Arrange for him to enter new social situations as gradually as possible. When you're going to a birthday party, for example, talk in advance about what the party will be like and how the child might greet her peers. First, I'll say, "Happy birthday, Joey," and then I'll say, "Hi, Sabrina." And make sure to get there early. It's much easier to be one of the earlier guests, so your child feels as if other people are joining him in a space that he owns, rather than having to break into a pre-existing group. Similarly, if your child is nervous before school starts for the year, bring him to see his classroom, and ideally, to meet the teacher one-on-one, as well as other friendly-looking adults, such as principals and guidance counselors, janitors and cafeteria workers. You can be subtle about this. "I've never seen your new classroom. Why don't we drive by and take a look?" Figure out together where the bathroom is, what the policy is for going there, the route from the classroom to the cafeteria, and where the school bus will pick him up at day's end. Arrange playdates during the summer with compatible kids from his class. You can also teach your child simple social strategies to get him through uncomfortable moments. Encourage him to look confident, even if he's not feeling it. Three simple reminders go a long way. Smile, stand up straight, and make eye contact. Teach him to look for friendly faces in a crowd. Bobby, a 3-year-old, didn't like going to his city preschool because at recess, the class left the safe confines of the classroom and played on the roof with the bigger kids in the older classes. He felt so intimidated that he wanted to go to school only on rainy days when there was no roof time. His parents helped him figure out which kids he felt comfortable playing with, and to understand that a noisy group of older boys didn't have to spoil his fun. If you think that you're not up to all this, or that your child could use extra practice, ask a pediatrician for help locating a social skills workshop in your area. These workshops teach kids how to enter groups, introduce themselves to new peers, and read body language and facial expressions, and they can help your child navigate what for many introverted kids is the trickiest part of their social lives, the school day. It's a Tuesday morning in October, and the fifth grade class at a public school in New York City is settling down for a lesson on the three branches of American government. The kids sit cross-legged on a rug in a brightly lit corner of the room, while their teacher, perched on a chair with a textbook in her lap, takes a few minutes to explain the basic concepts. Then it's time for a group activity applying the lesson. "This classroom gets so messy after lunch," says the teacher. "There's bubble gum under the tables, food wrappers everywhere, and cheese nips all over the floor. We don't like our room to be so messy, do we?" The students shake their heads no. "Today we're going to do something about this problem, together," says the teacher. She divides the class into three groups of 7 kids each, a legislative group, tasked with enacting a law to regulate lunchtime behavior, an executive group, which must decide how to enforce the law, and a judicial branch, which has to come up with a system for adjudicating messy eaters. The kids break excitedly into their groups, seating themselves in 3 large clusters. There's no need to move any furniture. Since so much of the curriculum is designed for group work, the classroom desks are already arranged in pods of 7 desks each. The room erupts in a merry din. Some of the kids who'd looked deathly bored during the 10-minute lecture are now chattering with their peers, but not all of them. When you see the kids as one big mass, they look like a room full of joyfully squirming puppies. But when you focus on individual children, like Maya, a redhead with a ponytail, wire-rimmed glasses, and a dreamy expression on her face, you get a strikingly different picture. In Maya's group, the executive branch, everyone is talking at once. Maya hangs back. Samantha, tall and plump in a purple t-shirt, takes charge. She pulls a sandwich bag from her knapsack and announces, "Whoever's holding the plastic bag gets to talk." The students pass around the bag, each contributing a thought in turn. They remind me of the kids in The Lord of the Flies, civic-mindedly passing around their conch shell, at least until all hell breaks loose. Maya looks overwhelmed when the bag makes its way to her. "I agree," she says. handing it like a hot potato to the next person. The bag circles the table several times. Each time, Maya passes it to her neighbor, saying nothing. Finally, the discussion is done. Maya looks troubled. She's embarrassed, I'm guessing, that she hasn't participated. Samantha reads from her notebook a list of enforcement mechanisms that the group has brainstormed. Rule number one, she says, if you break the laws, you miss recess. Wait, interrupts Maya. I have an idea. Go ahead, says Samantha, a little impatiently. But Maya, who, like many sensitive introverts, seems attuned to the subtlest cues for disapproval, notices the sharpness in Samantha's voice. She opens her mouth to speak, but lowers her eyes, only managing something rambling and unintelligible. No one can hear her. No one tries. The cool girl in the group, light years ahead of the rest in her slinkiness and fashion-forward clothes, sighs dramatically. Maya peters off in confusion, and the cool girl says, "Okay, Samantha, you can keep reading the rules now." The teacher asks the executive branch for a recap of its work. Everyone vies for airtime. Everyone except Maya. Samantha takes charge as usual, her voice carrying over everyone else's until the rest of the group falls silent. Her report doesn't make a lot of sense, but she's so confident and good-natured that it doesn't seem to matter. Maya, for her part, sits curled up at the periphery of the group, writing her name over and over again in her notebook in big block letters as if to reassert her identity, at least to herself. Earlier, Maya's teacher had told me that she's an intellectually alive student who shines in her essay writing. She's a gifted softball player, and she's kind to others, offering to tutor other children who lag behind academically. But none of Maya's positive attributes were evident that morning. Any parent would be dismayed to think that this was their child's experience of learning, of socializing, and of herself. Maya is an introvert. She is out of her element in a noisy and overstimulating classroom where lessons are taught in large groups. Her teacher told me that she'd do much better in a school with a calm atmosphere, where she could work with other kids who are equally hardworking and attentive to detail, and where a larger portion of the day would involve independent work. Maya needs to learn to assert herself in groups, of course, but will experiences like the one I witnessed teach her this skill? The truth is that many schools are designed for extroverts. Introverts need different kinds of instruction from extroverts, write College of William and Mary education scholars Jill Burris and Lisa Kenzig. And too often, very little is made available to that learner except constant advice on becoming more social and gregarious. We tend to forget that there's nothing sacrosanct about learning in large group classrooms, and that we organize students this way not because it's the best way to learn, but because it's cost-efficient. And what else would we do with our children while the grown-ups are at work? If your child prefers to work autonomously and socialize one-on-one, there's nothing wrong with her. She just happens not to fit the prevailing model. The purpose of school should be to prepare kids for the rest of their lives. But too often what kids need to be prepared for is surviving the school day itself. The school environment can be highly unnatural, especially from the perspective of an introverted child who loves to work intensely on projects he cares about and hang out with one or two friends at a time. In the morning, the door to the bus opens and discharges its occupants in a noisy, jostling mass. Academic classes are dominated by group discussions in which a teacher prods him to speak up. He eats lunch in the cacophonous din of the cafeteria, where he has to jockey for a place at a crowded table. Worst of all, there's little time to think or create. The structure of the day is almost guaranteed to sap his energy, rather than stimulate it. Why do we accept this one-size-fits-all situation as a given, when we know perfectly well that adults don't organize themselves this way? We often marvel at how introverted, geeky kids blossom into secure and happy adults. We liken it to a metamorphosis. However, maybe it's not the children who change, but their environments. As adults, they get to select the careers, spouses, and social circles that suit them. They don't have to live in whatever culture they're plunked into. Research from a field known as person-environment fit shows that people flourish when, In the words of psychologist Brian Little, they're engaged in occupations, roles, or settings that are concordant with their personalities. The inverse is also true. Kids stop learning when they feel emotionally threatened. No one knows this better than Lou Ann Johnson, a tough-talking former Marine and schoolteacher, widely recognized for educating some of the most troubled teens in the California public school system. Michelle Pfeiffer played her in the movie Dangerous Minds. I visited Johnson at her home in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, to find out more about her experience teaching children of all stripes. Johnson happens to be skilled at working with very shy children, which is no accident. One of her techniques is to share with her students how timid she herself used to be. Her earliest school memory is of being made to stand on a stool in kindergarten because she preferred to sit in the corner and read books, and the teacher wanted her to interact. Many shy children are thrilled to discover that their teacher had been as shy as they were, she told me. I remember one very shy girl in my high school English class whose mother thanked me for telling her daughter that I believed she would peak much later in life, so not to worry that she didn't shine in high school. She said that one comment had changed her daughter's entire outlook on life. Imagine, one offhand comment made such an impact on a tender child. When encouraging shy children to speak, says Johnson, it helps to make the topic so compelling that they forget their inhibitions. She advises asking students to discuss hot-button subjects like, boys have life a lot easier than girls do. Johnson, who is a frequent public speaker on education, despite a lifelong public speaking phobia, knows firsthand how well this works. I haven't overcome my shyness, she says. It is sitting in the corner, calling to me. But I am passionate about changing our schools, so my passion overcomes my shyness once I get started on a speech. If you find something that arouses your passion or provides a welcome challenge, you forget yourself for a while. It's like an emotional vacation. But don't risk having children make a speech to the class unless you've provided them with the tools to know with reasonable confidence that it will go well. Have kids practice with a partner and in small groups, and if they're still too terrified, don't force it. Experts believe that negative public speaking experiences in childhood can leave children with a lifelong terror of the podium. So what kind of school environment would work best for the Mayas of the world? First, some thoughts for teachers. Don't think of introversion as something that needs to be cured. If an introverted child needs help with social skills, teach her or recommend training outside class, just as you do for a student who needs extra attention in math or reading. But celebrate these kids for who they are. The typical comment on many children's report cards is, I wish Molly would talk more in class. Pat Adams, the former head of the Emerson School for Gifted Students in Ann Arbor, Michigan, told me. But here we have an understanding that many kids are introspective. We try to bring them out, but we don't make it a big deal. We think about introverted kids as having a different learning style. Studies show that one-third to one-half of us are introverts. This means that you have more introverted kids in your class than you think. Even at a young age, some introverts become adept at acting like extroverts, making it tough to spot them. Balance teaching methods to serve all the kids in your class. Extroverts tend to like movement, stimulation, collaborative work. Introverts prefer lectures, downtime, and independent projects. Mix it up fairly. Introverts often have one or two deep interests that are not necessarily shared by their peers. Sometimes they're made to feel freaky for the force of these passions, when in fact, studies show that this sort of intensity is a prerequisite to talent development. Praise these kids for their interests, encourage them, and help them find like-minded friends, if not in the classroom, then outside it. Some collaborative work is fine for introverts, even beneficial, but it should take place in small groups, pairs, or threesomes, and be carefully structured, so that each child knows her role. Roger Johnson, co-director of the Cooperative Learning Center at the University of Minnesota, says that shy or introverted kids benefit especially from well-managed small group work because They are usually very comfortable talking with one or two of their classmates to answer a question or complete a task, but would never think of raising their hand and addressing the whole class. It is very important that these students get a chance to translate their thoughts into language. Imagine how different Maya's experience would have been if her group had been smaller and someone had taken the time to say, "Samantha, you're in charge of keeping the discussion on track. Maya, your job is to take notes and read them back to the group." On the other hand, remember Anders Ericsson's research on deliberate practice from Chapter 3. In many fields, it's impossible to gain mastery without knowing how to work on one's own. Have your extroverted students take a page from their introverted peers' playbooks. Teach all kids to work independently. Don't seat quiet kids in high interaction areas of the classroom, says communications professor James McCroskey. They won't talk more in those areas. They'll feel more threatened and will have trouble concentrating. Make it easy for introverted kids to participate in class, but don't insist. Forcing highly apprehensive young people to perform orally is harmful, writes McCroskey. It will increase apprehension and reduce self-esteem. If your school has a selective admissions policy, think twice before basing your admissions decisions on children's performance in a playgroup setting. Many introverted kids clam up in groups of strangers, and you will not get even a glimpse of what these kids are like once they're relaxed and comfortable. And here are some thoughts for parents. If you're lucky enough to have control over where your child goes to school, whether by scouting out a magnet school, moving to a neighborhood whose public schools you like, or sending your kids to private or parochial school, you can look for a school that prizes independent interests and emphasizes autonomy, conducts group activities in moderation and in small, carefully managed groups, values kindness, caring, empathy, good citizenship, insists on orderly classrooms and hallways, is organized into small, quiet classes, chooses teachers who seem to understand the shy, serious, introverted, sensitive temperament, focuses its academic, athletic, extracurricular activities on subjects that are particularly interesting to your child, strongly enforces an anti-bullying program, emphasizes a tolerant, down-to-earth culture, attracts like-minded peers, for example, intellectual kids or artistic or athletic ones, depending on your child's preference. Handpicking a school may be unrealistic for many families, but whatever the school, there's much you can do to help your introverted child thrive. Figure out which subjects energize him most and let him run with them, either with outside tutors or extra programming like science fairs or creative writing classes. As for group activities, coach him to look for comfortable roles within larger groups. One of the advantages of group work, even for introverts, is that it often offers many different niches. Urge your child to take the initiative and claim for himself the responsibility of note-taker, picture-drawer, or whatever role interests him most. Participation will feel more comfortable when he knows what his contribution is supposed to be. You can also help him practice speaking up. Let him know that it's okay to take his time to gather his thoughts before he speaks, even if it seems as if everyone else is jumping into the fray. At the same time, advise him that contributing earlier in a discussion is a lot easier than waiting until everyone else has talked and letting the tension build as he waits to take his turn. If he's not sure what to say or is uncomfortable making assertions, help him play to his strengths. Does he tend to ask thoughtful questions? Praise this quality and teach him that good questions are often more useful than proposing answers. Does he tend to look at things from his own unique point of view? Teach him how valuable this is, and discuss how he might share his outlook with others. Explore real-life scenarios. For example, Maya's parents could sit down with her and figure out how she might have handled the executive group exercise differently. Try role-playing in situations that are as specific as possible. Maya could rehearse in her own words what it's like to say, "I'll be the note-taker," or, "What if we make a rule that anyone who throws wrappers on the floor has to spend the last 10 minutes of lunch picking up litter?" The catch is that this depends on getting Maya to open up and tell you what happened during her school day. Even if they're generally forthcoming, many kids won't share experiences that made them feel ashamed. The younger your child is, the more likely she is to open up. So you should start this process as early in her school career as possible. Ask your child for information in a gentle, non-judgmental way with specific, clear questions. Instead of, "How was your day?" try, "What did you do in math class today?" Instead of, "Do you like your teacher?" ask, "What do you like about your teacher?" or, "What do you not like so much?" Let her take her time to answer. Try to avoid asking, in the overly bright voice of parents everywhere, "Did you have fun in school today?" She'll sense how important it is that the answer be yes. If she still doesn't want to talk, wait for her. Sometimes she'll need to decompress for hours before she's ready. You may find that she'll open up only during cozy, relaxed moments, like bath time or bedtime. If that's the case, make sure to build these situations into the day. And if she'll talk to others, like a trusted babysitter, aunt, or older sibling, but not to you, swallow your pride and enlist help. Finally, try not to worry if all signs suggest that your introverted child is not the most popular kid at school. It's critically important for his emotional and social development that he have one or two solid friendships, child development experts tell us. But being popular isn't necessary. Many introverted kids grow up to have excellent social skills, although they tend to join groups in their own way, waiting a while before they plunge in, or participating only for short periods. That's okay. Your child needs to acquire social skills and make friends, not turn into the most gregarious student in school. This doesn't mean that popularity isn't a lot of fun. You'll probably wish it for him, just as you might wish that he have good looks, a quick wit, or athletic talent. But make sure you're not imposing your own longings, and remember that there are many paths to a satisfying life. Many of those paths will be found in passions outside the classroom. While extroverts are more likely to skate from one hobby or activity to another, introverts often stick with their enthusiasms. This gives them a major advantage as they grow, because true self-esteem comes from competence, not the other way around. Researchers have found that intense engagement in and commitment to an activity is a proven route to happiness and well-being. Well-developed talents and interests can be a great source of confidence for your child, no matter how different he might feel from his peers. For example, Maya, the girl who was such a quiet member of the executive branch, loves to go home every day after school and read. But she also loves softball, with all of its social and performance pressures. She still recalls the day she made the team after participating in tryouts. Maya was scared stiff, but she also felt strong, capable of hitting the ball with a good, powerful whack. "I guess all those drills finally paid off," she reflected later. "I just kept smiling. I was so excited and proud, and that feeling never went away." For parents, however, it's not always easy to orchestrate situations where these deep feelings of satisfaction arise. You might feel, for example, that you should encourage your introverted child to play whichever sport is the ticket to friendship and esteem in your town. And that's fine, if he enjoys that sport and is good at it, as Maya is with softball. Team sports can be a great boon for anyone, especially for kids who otherwise feel uncomfortable joining groups. But let your child take the lead in picking the activities he likes best. He may not like any team sports, and that's okay. Help him look for activities where he'll meet other kids, but also have plenty of his own space. Cultivate the strengths of his disposition. If his passions seem too solitary for your taste, remember that even solo activities, like painting, engineering, or creative writing, can lead to communities of fellow enthusiasts. I have known children who found others, says Dr. Miller, by sharing important interests, chess, elaborate role-playing games, even discussing deep interests like math or history. Rebecca Wallace Siegel, who teaches creative writing workshops for kids and teens as director of Writopia Lab in New York City, says that the students who sign up for her classes are often not the kids who are willing to talk for hours about fashion and celebrity. Those kids are less likely to come, perhaps because they're less inclined to analyze and dig deep. That's not their comfort zone. The so-called shy kids are often hungry to brainstorm ideas, deconstruct them, and act on them. And, paradoxically, when they're allowed to interact this way, they're not shy at all. They're connecting with each other, but in a deeper zone, in a place that's considered boring or tiresome by some of their peers. And these kids do come out when they're ready. Most of the Writopia kids read their works at local bookstores, and a staggering number win prestigious national writing competitions. If your child is prone to overstimulation, then it's also a good idea for her to pick activities like art or long-distance running that depend less on performing under pressure. If she's drawn to activities that require performance, though, you can help her thrive. When I was a kid, I loved figure skating. I could spend hours on the rink, tracing figure eights, spinning happily, or flying through the air. But on the day of my competitions, I was a wreck. I hadn't slept the night before, and would often fall during moves that I had sailed through in practice. At first, I believed what people told me, that I had the jitters, just like everybody else. But then I saw a TV interview with the Olympic gold medalist Katarina Witt. She said that pre-competition nerves gave her the adrenaline she needed to win the gold. I knew then that Katarina and I were utterly different creatures, but it took me decades to figure out why. Her nerves were so mild that they simply energized her, while mine were constricting enough to make me choke. At the time, my very supportive mother quizzed the other skating moms about how their own daughters handled pre-competition anxiety and came back with insights that she hoped would make me feel better. Kristen's nervous, too, she reported. Renee's mom says she's scared the night before a competition. But I knew Kristen and Renee well, and I was certain that they weren't as frightened as I was. I think it might have helped if I'd understood myself better back then. If you're the parent of a would-be figure skater, help her to accept that she has heavy-duty jitters without giving her the idea that they're fatal to success. What she's most afraid of is failing publicly. She needs to desensitize herself to this fear by getting used to competing and even to failing. Encourage her to enter low-stakes competitions far away from home, where she feels anonymous and no one will know if she falls. Make sure she has rehearsed thoroughly. If she's planning to compete on an unfamiliar rink, try to have her practice there a few times first. Talk about what might go wrong and how to handle it. Okay, so what if you do fall and come in last place? Will life still go on? And help her visualize what it will feel like to perform her moves smoothly. Unleashing a passion can transform a life, not just for the space of time that your child's in elementary or middle or high school, but way beyond. Consider the story of David Weiss, a drummer and music journalist. David is a good example of someone who grew up feeling like Charlie Brown and went on to build a life of creativity, productivity, and meaning. He loves his wife and baby son. He relishes his work. He has a wide and interesting circle of friends and lives in New York City, which he considers the most vibrant place in the world for a music enthusiast. If you measure a life by the classic barometers of love and work, then David is a blazing success. But it wasn't always clear, at least not to David, that his life would unfold as well as it did. As a kid, he was shy and awkward. The things that interested him, music and writing, held no value for the people who mattered most back then, his peers. People would always tell me, "These are the best years of your life," he recalls, and I would think to myself, I hope not. I hated school. I remember thinking, I've got to get out of here. I was in sixth grade when Revenge of the Nerds came out, and I looked like I stepped out of the cast. I knew I was intelligent, but I grew up in suburban Detroit, which is like 99% of the rest of the country. If you're a good-looking person and an athlete, you're not going to get hassled. But if you seem too smart, that's not something that kids respect you for. They're more likely to try and beat you down for it. It was my best attribute, and I definitely enjoyed using it, but it was something you also had to try and keep in check. So, how did he get from there to here? The key for David was playing the drums. At one point, David says, I totally overcame all my childhood stuff, and I know exactly how. I started playing the drums. Drums are my muse. They're my Yoda. When I was in middle school, the high school jazz band came and performed for us, and I thought that the coolest one by a long shot was the kid playing the drum set. To me, drummers were kind of like athletes, but musical athletes, and I loved music. At first, for David, drumming was mostly about social validation. He stopped getting kicked out of parties by jocks twice his size. But soon it became something much deeper. I suddenly realized this was a form of creative expression, and it totally blew my mind. I was 15. That's when I became committed to sticking with it. My entire life changed because of my drums, and it hasn't stopped to this day. David still remembers acutely what it was like to be his 9-year-old self. I feel like I'm in touch with that person today, he says. Whenever I'm doing something that I think is cool, like if I'm in New York City in a room full of people, interviewing Alicia Keys or something, I send a message back to that person and let him know that everything turned out okay. I feel like when I was 9, I was receiving that signal from the future, which is one of the things that gave me the strength to hang in there. I was able to create this loop between who I am now and who I was then. The other thing that gave David strength was his parents. They focused less on developing his confidence than on making sure that he found ways to be productive. It didn't matter what he was interested in, so long as he pursued it and enjoyed himself. His father was an avid football fan, David recalls, but the last person to say, "How come you're not out on the football field?" For a while, David took up piano, then cello. When he announced that he wanted to switch to drumming, his parents were surprised, but never wavered. They embraced his new passion. It was their way of embracing their son. If David Weiss's tale of transformation resonates for you, there's a good reason. It's a perfect example of what the psychologist Dan McAdams calls a redemptive life story and a sign of mental health and well-being. At the Foley Center for the Study of Lives at Northwestern University, McAdams studies the stories that people tell about themselves. We all write our life stories as if we were novelists, McAdams believes, with beginnings, conflicts, turning points, and endings. And the way we characterize our past setbacks profoundly influences how satisfied we are with our current lives. Unhappy people tend to see setbacks as contaminants that ruined an otherwise good thing. I was never the same again after my wife left me. While generative adults see them as blessings in disguise. The divorce was the most painful thing that ever happened to me, but I'm so much happier with my new wife. Those who live the most fully realized lives, giving back to their families, societies, and ultimately themselves, tend to find meaning in their obstacles. In a sense, McAdams has breathed new life into one of the great insights of Western mythology, that where we stumble is where our treasure lies. For many introverts like David, adolescence is the great stumbling place, the dark and tangled thicket of low self-esteem and social unease. In middle and high school, the main currency is vivacity and gregariousness. Attributes like depth and sensitivity don't count for much. But many introverts succeed in composing life stories much like David's. Our Charlie Brown moments are the price we have to pay to bang our drums happily through the decades. Conclusion. Wonderland. Our culture made a virtue of living only as extroverts. We discouraged the inner journey, the quest for a center. So we lost our center and have to find it again. Anais Nin. Whether you're an introvert yourself or an extrovert who loves or works with one, I hope you'll benefit personally from the insights in this book. Here is a blueprint to take with you. Love is essential. Gregariousness is optional. Cherish your nearest and dearest. Work with colleagues you like and respect. Scan new acquaintances for those who might fall into the former categories or whose company you enjoy for its own sake. And don't worry about socializing with everyone else. Relationships make everyone happier, introverts included. But think quality over quantity. The secret to life is to put yourself in the right lighting. For some, it's a Broadway spotlight. For others, a lamp-lit desk. Use your natural powers of persistence, concentration, insight, and sensitivity to do work you love and work that matters. Solve problems. Make art. Think deeply. Figure out what you are meant to contribute to the world and make sure you contribute it. If this requires public speaking or networking or other activities that make you uncomfortable, do them anyway. But accept that they're difficult. Get the training you need to make them easier and reward yourself when you're done. Quit your job as a TV anchor and get a degree in library science. But if TV anchoring is what you love, then create an extroverted persona to get yourself through the day. Here's a rule of thumb for networking events. One new, honest-to-goodness relationship is worth 10 fistfuls of business cards. Rush home afterward and kick back on your sofa. Carve out restorative niches. Respect your loved one's need for socializing and your own for solitude, and vice versa if you're an extrovert. Spend your free time the way you like, not the way you think you're supposed to. Stay home on New Year's Eve if that's what makes you happy. Skip the committee meeting. Cross the street to avoid making aimless chit-chat with random acquaintances. Read. Cook. Run. Write a story. Make a deal with yourself that you'll attend a set number of social events in exchange for not feeling guilty when you beg off. If your children are quiet, help them make peace with new situations and new people, but otherwise, let them be themselves. Delight in the originality of their minds. Take pride in the strength of their consciences and the loyalty of their friendships. Don't expect them to follow the gang. Encourage them to follow their passions instead. Throw confetti when they claim the fruits of those passions, whether it's on the drummer's throne, on the softball field, or on the page. If you're a teacher, enjoy your gregarious and participatory students. But don't forget to cultivate the shy, the gentle, the autonomous, the ones with single-minded enthusiasms for chemistry sets or parrot taxonomy or 19th century art. They are the artists, engineers, and thinkers of tomorrow. If you're a manager, remember that one-third to one-half of your workforce is probably introverted, whether they appear that way or not. Think twice about how you design your organization's office space. Don't expect introverts to get jazzed up about open office plans, or for that matter, lunchtime birthday parties or team-building retreats. Make the most of introverts' strengths. These are the people who can help you think deeply, strategize, solve complex problems, and spot canaries in your coal mine. Also, remember the dangers of the new groupthink. If it's creativity you're after, ask your employees to solve problems alone before sharing their ideas. If you want the wisdom of the crowd, gather it electronically or in writing, and make sure people can't see each other's ideas until everyone's had a chance to contribute. Face-to-face contact is important because it builds trust, but group dynamics contain unavoidable impediments to creative thinking. Arrange for people to interact one-on-one and in small, casual groups. Don't mistake assertiveness or eloquence for good ideas. If you have a proactive workforce, and I hope you do, remember that they may perform better under an introverted leader than under an extroverted or charismatic one. Whoever you are, bear in mind that appearance is not reality. Some people act like extroverts, but the effort costs them in energy, authenticity, and even physical health. Others seem aloof or self-contained, but their inner landscapes are rich and full of drama. So the next time you see a person with a composed face and a soft voice, remember that inside her mind, she might be solving an equation, composing a sonnet, designing a hat. She might, that is, be deploying the powers of quiet. We know from myths and fairy tales that there are many different kinds of powers in this world. One child is given a lightsaber, another a wizard's education. The trick is not to amass all the different kinds of available power, but to use well the kind you've been granted. Introverts are offered keys to private gardens full of riches. To possess such a key is to tumble like Alice down her rabbit hole. She didn't choose to go to Wonderland, but she made of it an adventure that was fresh and fantastic and very much her own. Lewis Carroll was an introvert too, by the way. Without him, there would be no Alice in Wonderland. And by now, this shouldn't surprise us. A note on the dedication. My grandfather was a soft-spoken man with sympathetic blue eyes and a passion for books and ideas. He always dressed in a suit and had a courtly way of exclaiming over whatever was exclaimable in people, especially in children. In the Brooklyn neighborhood where he served as a rabbi, the sidewalks were filled with men in black hats, women in skirts that hid their knees, and improbably well-behaved kids. On his way to synagogue, my grandfather would greet the passers-by, gently praising this child's brains, that one's height, the other's command of current events. Kids adored him, businessmen respected him, lost souls clung to him. But what he loved to do best was read. In his small apartment, where as a widower he'd lived alone for decades, all the furniture had yielded its original function to serve as a surface for piles of books, gold-leafed Hebrew texts jumbled together with Margaret Atwood and Milan Kundera. My grandfather would sit beneath a halo-shaped fluorescent light at his tiny kitchen table, sipping Lipton tea and snacking on marble cake, a book propped open on the white cotton tablecloth. In his sermons, each a tapestry of ancient and humanist thought, he'd share with his congregation the fruits of that week's study. He was a shy person who had trouble making eye contact with the audience, but he was so bold in his spiritual and intellectual explorations that when he spoke, the congregation swelled to standing room only. The rest of my family took its cue from him. In our house, reading was the primary group activity. On Saturday afternoons, we curled up with our books in the den. It was the best of both worlds. You had the animal warmth of your family right next to you, but you also got to roam around the adventure land inside your own head. Yet as a preteen, I began to wonder whether all this reading had marked me as out of it, a suspicion that seemed confirmed when I went away to summer camp at the age of 10 and watched as a girl with thick glasses and a high forehead refused to put down her book on the all-important first day of camp and instantly became a pariah, her days and nights a hell of social exclusion. I longed to read, too, but left my own paperbacks untouched in my suitcase, though I felt guilty about this, as if the books needed me and I was forsaking them. I saw that the girl who kept reading was considered bookish and shy, the very things that I was, too, and knew that I must hide. After that summer, I felt less comfortable about my desire to be alone with a book. In high school, in college, and as a young lawyer, I tried to make myself appear more extroverted and less egg-heady than I truly was. But as I grew older, I drew inspiration from my grandfather's example. He was a quiet man, and a great one, when he died at the age of 94, after 62 years at the pulpit. The NYPD had to close the streets of his neighborhood to accommodate the throngs of mourners. He would have been surprised to know this. Today, I think that one of the best things about him was his humility. This book is dedicated, with love, to my childhood family, to my mother, with her endless enthusiasm for quiet kitchen table chats. She gave us children the gift of intimacy. I was so lucky to have such a devoted mother. To my father, a dedicated physician who taught by example the joys of sitting for hours at a desk hunting for knowledge, but who also came up for air to introduce me to his favorite poems and science experiments. To my brother and sister, who share to this day the warmth and affection of having grown up in our small family and household full of literature. To my grandmother, for her pluck, grit, and caring. And in memory of my grandfather, who spoke so eloquently the language of quiet. A note on the words introvert and extrovert. This book is about introversion as seen from a cultural point of view. Its primary concern is the age-old dichotomy between the man of action and the man of contemplation, and how we could improve the world if only there were a greater balance of power between the two types. It focuses on the person who recognizes him or herself somewhere in the following constellation of attributes: reflective, cerebral, bookish, unassuming, sensitive, thoughtful, serious, contemplative, subtle, introspective, inner-directed, gentle, calm, modest, solitude-seeking, shy, risk-averse, thin-skinned. Quiet is also about this person's opposite number, the man of action, who is ebullient, expansive, sociable, gregarious, excitable, dominant, assertive, active, risk-taking, thick-skinned, outer-directed, light-hearted, bold, and comfortable in the spotlight. These are broad categories, of course. Few individuals identify fully with only one or the other. But most of us recognize these types immediately, because they play meaningful roles in our culture. Contemporary personality psychologists may have a conception of introversion and extroversion that differs from the one I use in this book. Adherents of the Big Five taxonomy often view such characteristics as the tendency to have a cerebral nature, a rich inner life, a strong conscience, some degree of anxiety, especially shyness, and a risk-averse nature as belonging to categories quite separate from introversion. To them, these traits may fall under openness to experience, conscientiousness, and neuroticism. My use of the word introvert is deliberately broader, drawing on the insights of Big Five psychology, but also encompassing Jungian thinking on the introvert's inner world of inexhaustible charm and subjective experience. Jerome Kagan's research on high reactivity and anxiety, see chapters 4 and 5, Elaine Aron's work on sensory processing sensitivity and its relationship to conscientiousness, intense feeling, inner directedness, and depth of processing, see chapter 6, and various research on the persistence and concentration that introverts bring to problem solving, much of it summarized wonderfully in Gerald Matthews' work, see chapter 7. Indeed, for over 3,000 years, Western culture has linked the qualities in the above constellations of adjectives. As the anthropologist C.A. Valentine once wrote, Western cultural traditions include a conception of individual variability, which appears to be old, widespread, and persistent. In popular form, this is the familiar notion of the man of action, practical man, realist, or sociable person, as opposed to the thinker, dreamer, idealist, or shy individual. The most widely used labels associated with this tradition are the type designations extrovert and introvert. Valentine's concept of introversion includes traits that contemporary psychology would classify as openness to experience, thinker-dreamer, conscientiousness, idealist, and neuroticism, shy individual. A long line of poets, scientists, and philosophers have also tended to group these traits together. All the way back in Genesis, the earliest book of the Bible, we had cerebral Jacob, a quiet man dwelling in tents, who later becomes Israel, meaning one who wrestles inwardly with God, squaring off in sibling rivalry with his brother, the swashbuckling Esau, a skillful hunter and man of the field. In classical antiquity, the physicians Hippocrates and Galen famously proposed that our temperaments and destinies were a function of our bodily fluids, with extra blood and yellow bile making us sanguine or choleric, stable or neurotic extroversion, and an excess of phlegm and black bile making us calm or melancholic, stable or neurotic introversion. Aristotle noted that the melancholic temperament was associated with eminence in philosophy, poetry, and the arts. Today we might classify this as openness to experience. The 17th century English poet John Milton wrote Il Penseroso, the thinker, and L'Allegro, the merry one, comparing the happy person, who frolics in the countryside and revels in the city, with the thoughtful person, who walks meditatively through the nighttime woods and studies in a lonely tower. Again, today the description of Il Penseroso would apply not only to introversion, but also to openness to experience and neuroticism. The 19th century German philosopher Schopenhauer contrasted good-spirited people, energetic, active, and easily bored, with his preferred type, intelligent people, sensitive, imaginative, and melancholic. "Mark this well, ye proud men of action," declared his countryman, Heinrich Heine. "Ye are, after all, nothing but unconscious instruments of the men of thought." Because of this definitional complexity, I originally planned to invent my own terms for these constellations of traits. I decided against this, again for cultural reasons. The words introvert and extrovert have the advantage of being well known and highly evocative. Every time I uttered them at a dinner party or to a seatmate on an airplane, they elicited a torrent of confessions and reflections. For similar reasons, I've used the layperson's spelling of extrovert rather than the extravert one finds throughout the research literature. This is Kate Amazer. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking by Susan Cain. This program was directed by Fred Sanders, executive producer Janet Stark. Text copyright 2012 by Susan Cain. Production copyright 2012, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.